specifically what it means to be working from an anti-state position when you're forced to contend with state institutions. So we just were talking with a comrade from the Lakeview sit-in, so what it means to be working sort of directly from a state institution like a school, how that forces you to have to negotiate in certain ways with school district, with legality, with the police. And now we're going to transition to talk about, the school's biggest competition for funds in California, which is the prison system. So we have two folks here that do some really important work. I'd like to just invite you to introduce yourselves first and talk about what kind of projects related to prisons you work with.
I live and work in Oakland, California. I work with middle schoolers in East Oakland. And I also do different forms of organizing against imprisonment and policing, and do a lot of work supporting people who are currently locked up.
I also live in Oakland. I'm a grad student by day, and I also work at an on-site college program in San Quentin State Prison with inmates in there who are enrolled to get their AA degrees.
Great. So the theme that we kind of wanted to explore was sort of an ongoing theme on our show is the question of solidarity and sort of how you move beyond sort of traditional solidarity. And I think the work that both of you do in terms of working with folks that are locked up, folks that are inside, that is all about a solidarity that literally crosses a border, right? The border of those institutions. So a really tremendous thing happened last year that was so underexposed. I feel like people really still are hearing about it for the first time. It's the one-year anniversary, as we know, of the Pelican Bay hunger strike. So maybe we could start out just talking a little bit about what that is, what happened, why it's so significant, and sort of what kinds of challenges come up for thinking about sort of prison-related activism.
So last year on July 1st, a couple dozen prisoners in the Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, also known as the SHU, launched a hunger strike, and they put out five core demands. The first demand was to end administrative abuse and group punishment. The second demand is to end the debriefing policy, which I'll get into in a second. The third demand was to comply with this piece of policy that passed through in 2006 that put a lot of different regulations on the use of solitary confinement that Pelican Bay CDCR, California Department of Corrections, does not follow at all. And so that's what the third demand is in reference to. The fourth demand is to provide adequate food, which is a very basic demand. And the fifth demand is to provide privileges and constructive programming for people who are placed in the SHU. So things like being able to take correspondence courses, being able to have art supplies, being able to actually go to the yard, et cetera, et cetera. So not very many people even know what the security housing unit is. It's basically the end of the line for people in California. So it's the idea that it's the state's most severe punishment that it can serve you besides death. And basically what it is it's a very small cell. They're usually 6 by 10 foot feet, the standard size of a bathroom. And it basically is a bathroom. You have a toilet in there and kind of a bed, not really. There aren't any windows and there are fluorescent lights that are just on 24 hours a day. And you're locked in there 22 and a half to 24 hours a day. And many people are locked in there for years and years and years and years at a time. So one prisoner, Hugo Pinnell, who's a political prisoner, he was part of the San Quentin Six, he organized with George Jackson in the 70s. He's been in solitary confinement for 40 years now. He has not been with other prisoners in 4 decades. So this is obviously a form of torture, a basic form of torture. Going back to demand number two, the only thing that gets you out of the SHU is if you debrief, which basically means that you have to offer up information about other prisoners in relation to gang status. So the primary reason why people are placed in the SHU is because the CDCR is on this witch hunt of trying to track down certain gang members, and it's part of this agenda that we see outside of prison too, right? Where the main way that working class communities are criminalized, particularly when they're organized, is by calling them gangs, right? You can actually trace back, and I encourage everyone who's listening to actually study the history of gangs and actually how the criminalization of gangs has come to be about in the United States, because it really shows what the state and the system is all about, and how the prison industrial complex serves to protect the status quo and capitalism. But this hunger strike was really, really huge. It was started by just a couple dozen people, and it quickly spread. In the first 4 days of the strike, it spread to a third of the state's prisons, so over 6,600 people throughout the state, in general population in prisons, as well as in maximum security, were participating. They were refusing food. It lasted for almost 4 weeks, and the prisoners effectively pushed the CDCR into negotiations after they said that, you know, they refused to do that for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. The prisoners were not satisfied with, you know, the really bullshit response that CDCR ended up giving through those negotiations, so they relaunched a second phase of the hunger strike on September 26th of last year, and the strike doubled. It reached over 12,000 people throughout the state. So this is really remarkable. I think a lot of the time you hear organizers and activists talking about different fears of repression, and I can't actually think of anybody else who would have more to lose and more to fear by organizing. And also I also hear organizers and activists constantly complain about how hard it is to communicate with each other, and I also can't imagine what it would mean to communicate and effectively organize one of the largest prison strikes in recent decades while being locked in a bathroom and not actually being able to see anybody face to face, and having all of your communication and contact with basic people be completely illegal. So I think it's one of the most courageous examples of organizing currently. And the fight's still continuing. They're still pushing to get these demands won. And what this organizing has gone into is now what could be a class action lawsuit that has the potential to get all shoes shut down in California, which is really, really huge. So I think it also raises some interesting questions and opportunities for people to explore what is that relationship between grassroots organizing, particularly organizing that holds anti-state or anti-capitalist analysis, right? With, you know, how we can go about using the legislative tools that do make some pretty big shifts on a larger institutional level for our benefit, right? And that's not to say that when the state makes certain reforms of itself or of its institutions or tools, that those are victories for us, but I see them more as opportunities, right? So I just think that maybe we can keep coming back to this example as we continue talking, but it definitely started last year, and a lot of family members also have joined this fight who weren't organizers before, you know, and just have really struggled with not being able to see their sons, their brothers, their husbands, their lovers for decades at a time, and they want their people to be able to come home, and so this is a moment in which they're becoming politicized, and they're really becoming much more dedicated to a larger struggle besides just supporting their individual loved ones.
I think it's important to what the Pelican Bay hunger strike really raises for us is that, you know, for as long as the prison industrial complex, or prisons, I should say, have been around, the state has used prisons as sites or locations to perfect these kind of violent tools, you know. So the shoe is just one example, and I think you put it perfectly when you said that it's a mode of torture, right? And so to me, it seems ridiculous that like anti-war organizing doesn't call attention to the way that prisons operate and perfect tools of torture. And it's also ridiculous that, well, not I shouldn't say ridiculous because I understand that some of these connections are really difficult to make. But I think for us, it's a constant reminder. The hunger strike is a constant reminder that the state has been using prisons as locations to perfect state tools for centuries, and not to erase that history just because people who are locked up often do get erased from our collective memories. One of my favorite stories of when the hunger strike began is I was going inside pretty often at that point, and a couple of our students, you know, were like, telling me what was going on, right? Like, they knew before I even knew, as a free person, like, what was happening. And so the way that these channels of communication, the more the state intensifies repression and intensifies our inability to talk to one another, that there are still these avenues of resistance, you know, that word is getting out and people are communicating to each other. And many people inside also went on hunger strike who weren't in the SHU as a point of solidarity to say, you know, we're actually not going to engage in practices that put our brethren under the bus, right? And to hear them talk about that as a history, right? That prisons, hunger strikes have a history and this is what they are, and like, and engaging in these kinds of political education with one another within this severely repressive institution is something that we should all learn from, right?
Yeah, a really interesting question that's coming up is like how folks get politicized around these institutions, right? So, you know, the connection again back to the question of the schools is really, you know, I think the woman that we were talking with earlier was raising the similar issue of, you know, folks that aren't activists, they're not organizers, but because of what they're forced to contend with in these institutions, they become politicized, they become active, they become organized, you know, and they become organizers, right? And so to hear about, you know, family members of incarcerated folks that are actively participating in, you know, organizing around the hunger strike and around you know, policy reform, but also around the real kind of day-to-day sort of solidarity work that is vital to the survival of folks, you know, I mean, it's really, really inspiring. And I think, you know, what we were hearing about, you know, thinking what it means to organize from inside and, you know, the obstacles that we seem to face outside in organizing, it's, I think, really a powerful sort of space to learn from. So this kind of tension between policy reform, between sort of processes that kind of like bolster the institutions and that kind of reinforce the institutions, and a kind of political perspective and political struggle to really want to see these institutions disappear. You know, that kind of tension is huge because, like you say, it's not about not seeing these things as victories, these, you know, moments of policy reform. They are important, absolutely. But how to sort of weigh that tension and that balance in figuring out where to sort of put your energy, right? So it'd be great to hear how both of you sort of negotiate that a little bit in the work that you do.
That one hits really close to home, right? But it's kind of it's a situation of both and. Like, I think the recent Supreme Court decision that came down, especially in relation to life without parole being barred for youth or juveniles that are facing these charges, right? Like, this seemingly is a victory, right, for the left and for progressives. And it's something that gives a lot of people a lot of hope, especially if they do have, if their children are inside, right, and contending with life without parole and now have the ability to come back into the courts and hopefully be free, right? But it's about like framing it that even though it seems like a victory, we can't fall into the language or this kind of glimmer at the end of the road, that what we need to do is build different structures in order to account for a world that we need, and having multiple kinds of conversations with people at the same time, right? I think our really good friend likes to say that it's fighting the war of position and the war of maneuver, right? That like it's about being able to see that there's one big enemy at the end of this, right, which is the state and capitalism, but along the way there's going to be multiple enemies, multiple victories, and multiple losses, and being able to be dedicated to the long haul. And I think that people, once that opening is created to have that kind of conversation, a lot of energy is motivated, that, you know, we can imagine a world outside of these big institutions. But on the day-to-day, it's really hard to manifest. Like, every time I go inside, I have to compromise my politics to a certain degree, right, to be able to interact with cops so that classes can run in a given night and guys have some place to go. Like, that's a really difficult challenge to have to, like, grin and bear it when cops are sexually harassing me on the way down to education, right, just so we can get 300 guys out of their cells to be able to just interact with each other. And those little victories, you know, being able to do that, being able to create that space is really important. But along the way, it's like so much trauma gets dealt with, not just for me, like at all, but for the guys too, right? Like constantly having to be policed and have somebody threaten to take away that freedom from them, which is just a fractional freedom, is a really difficult thing to witness and to not be able to really intervene in. But that's that. I always have to remember, right? Like one day I will never have to walk into a prison because there won't be prisons to walk into, right? The guys will have the ability to really get everything they need in their childhood and up until their adult life, right? And not have to fight for it in this way. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just my head went directly towards like what all of this is actually about. Like, what is it that people are trying to actually do, right? So it's like, we do what we do because we want to get free. And we want everybody to be free, and we don't want our communities to live in the devastation that we have to live with every single fucking day, right? Sorry for my language.
No.
But,
no,
you know, the main tool, the main system that is set into place to protect the status quo of capitalism and white supremacy that wreaks this havoc and creates this devastation of our communities and all of this alienation and exploitation that we all experience to various degrees, right, is the prison industrial complex, right? And so I think like that framework to understand our reality is really, really important, right? Because if we actually understand what the prison industrial complex is, as this system of overlapping interests of industry and government, right, that uses all of these tools to maintain capitalism and white supremacy, such as curfews, such as different forms of policing, imprisonment, surveillance, gang injunctions, metal detectors, GPS, et cetera, right, criminalization of just everyday activities and of just people, right, to dehumanize us. If we actually understand that, then we understand that it's not broken, right? Like, we understand that it works exactly as it's designed to. And if we really understand that, then we know the only option is really to abolish it, right? Like, we don't need to reform it because it is a reform, right? Like, imprisonment is a reform of capital and corporal punishment, right? And, you know, policing is constantly being reformed from the Measure Y neighborhood cops that we see walking around in West Oakland, you know, and the security that are, you know, the pigs that are called resource officers at schools, right? Like, a cop is a cop is a cop, a cage is a cage is a cage. No matter how you dress it up or change it, it serves a very particular purpose, right? So I think, like, in terms of that tension, you know, I mean, it's like, that's very clear, and then meanwhile, you know, we're all being raised within this context, and none of us are like born a seasoned revolutionary, right? Like, we all come through with our experiences and at different times really start to see and piece together what the hell is going on, you know? And I think it takes a certain amount of just like understanding and humility, to use more liberal terms, right? For like people to actually treat each other like people and to remember that like we all came from a point where we actually did think that something else was going on here, right? And I think that that's the hard thing with a lot of organizers, is it's very easy to kind of get lost in egos or whatever, where thinking that you're revolutionary gives you a right or a reason to further alienate people who seem ordinary. And that's exactly why we don't have the movements that we need to have to actually make like real long-lasting change, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think like, you know, the guys in Pelican Bay didn't have the luxury of not making demands to the state in order to go on this hunger strike, right? They also didn't make demands to all be free, right? Like, they made very, like, they know none of these guys will ever get out of prison. You know, like, they will be in prison for the rest of their life, but they're hoping to not be in a bathroom for the rest of their life. You know, they are hoping to get, you know, more visits with their family and that kind of stuff, you know, and that is part of revolutionary struggle, right? Because one of the most basic things about a revolutionary struggle is that we're trying to reassert our humanity, and you can't be human if you can't have basic contact with the people that you love and where you come from.
Yeah, you know, going back to how we sort of opened up the show, thinking about sort of what characterizes state relations and what characterizes the kind of relationships that we want to see and we want to create as part of the anti-state work we do, which, you know, I think anti-state and anti-capitalism absolutely go hand in hand, but also in just sort of a process of recovering some humanity, right? The humanity that's sort of stripped away from us by these institutions of the state and the sort of violence of the state. So it's about recovering that humanity, which I think is, you know, so clearly sort of the core of the work that you both do, is like finding small moments of sort of reconstructing some sense of human connection, right, in a space that does everything to take that away. So the kind of framing that we had of, you know, what anti-state relations look like, you know, it's about a process of sort of ongoing process of building community, and it's about sort of relations that are dynamic and sort of ever-shifting and sort of always provisional. So I'd love to hear sort of your ideas about that, sort of what the kind of day-to-day looks like in terms of building those relationships, right? Especially in a situation that is, everything is controlled, everything is monitored, everything is measured and restricted, you know, to such an extreme point. So how to find that kind of like, that space?
I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is like recently we just had a graduation on site. We had 10 graduates that successfully got their AAs with this program. And, you know, like, nobody would say that academia is like a pure space of liberation. Like, in fact, it's totally the opposite, right? It alienates all of those within it. But just to be able, so there's 10 graduates, and, you know, there were so many long, hard days of trying to contact their family members and like get information to get transportation to get people to come, and then like make sure that those guys could get off work that day, right? Because they have to work, make sure that they weren't doing any kind of like institutional work besides their normal jobs, right? Like whatever it is that, whatever other means to exploit their time the state uses, right? And then finally, like everybody got in there and in graduation, and all of our alumni could come. And there's this moment, and I'll never forget this, is like, I remember walking in, I was one of the last persons in, and just to see like a bunch of guys, you know, in their CDCR blues, sitting alongside Free People, as they call us, right? Like, just like no barricades, no boundaries, like the first time, it's probably the only time that CDCR allows people to sit alongside each other, right? So people are sitting with their families, people are sitting with their cousins, their best friends who came from like Texas with their teachers, right? The teachers that taught them these classes. And I remember the first, like one of the first conversations that day was about, oh yeah, so this is my 101 instructor and we read Fanon for her class. And then this guy's mom was like, what was Fanon about? And they're having this conversation about like Fanon and the notion of like violence being cathartic, and we just have to like exert and practice violence against the colonizer, like inside prison, you know? And you're just like, I had this moment where it's like, is this exactly what this struggle is about, right? It's like these moments of contact, and how can we prolong this for a lifetime, right? How can we make it so that it's not just within 20 minutes? And I think like everything else disappears, right? Every point of struggle disappears after that. But I just think about like how difficult it must be in your life when you don't have access to the people that you love on a regular basis, and how hard it is, right, for guys to be able to do that. But that's totally not answering the question that you asked. But it is this thing of like, I also think that part of it is that we have such a short-term memory problem, right? Like, that it's hard to see our isolated everyday events as part of a long continuing struggle. And that moment to me really exemplifies this idea of like, it may be provisional, these like brief moments of liberation or freedom or whatever you want to call it, but it's there. And we can't forget those, because those are the reasons why we kind of get up in the morning and engage in the ways that we do struggle, right? It makes all those other things disappear.
Yeah, I think, you know, reclaiming, asserting our humanity needs to be at the forefront of the work that we're doing. And so, and it definitely was in terms of supporting the hunger strike and like really what the core of the hunger strike is all about, right? And so that was the approach that we took to supporting it. You know, so prisoners are never referred to as prisoners in the media, right? Like, public opinion calls them inmates, calls them monsters, calls them all of these terrible things, right? So a lot of the work that, you know, we did in terms of trying to, like, build and galvanize support was just painting a much different picture, which is, like, a real picture, right? Is that, like, these are all actually people, right? They have wives, they have kids, they have families. A lot of them aren't in touch with their blood families anymore because prison has completely torn their families apart, right? So they've created new families, both inside and outside, with advocates and other people, et cetera, you know? And, you know, I think that that's really at the forefront. I think in terms of, like, supporting and working with prisoners is just remembering that, for the most part, people are walking around with this ideology that prisoners aren't people. And that the second that you do something that lands you in prison, you lose the right to say that you're actually a person. You know, I think in terms of, like, the work that I do with young people in schools, that's, like, another example. It's, like, a fine line, right? It's, like, young people are people and recognized. Well, I mean, oftentimes adults don't treat them as if they're human beings at all, really treat them more like puppy dogs or, you know, something not okay, right? And, you know, or there's this fine line of, like, I'll treat you as a person so long as you stay within this very clear, like, roped off section that I have for you. And the second that you cross that line, we have no more space to actually support you or to treat you like a human being. You know, and so I think, like, in terms of that, it's just about, like, really building relationships with young people and using, like, an abolitionist lens to guide your work, right? To, like, think of anti-capitalism in very concrete ways that are relevant to young people, right? And supporting them and realizing that all the crap that they're going through, you know, is kind of like a microcosm for society at large, right? Like, middle school is a microcosm of capitalism, basically. You know, everyone's an asshole to each other. Like, you know, everyone's dehumanizing each other every second that they get, right? But the thing that's awesome about working with middle schoolers is they also haven't lost this, like, really inherent sense of resiliency and rebellion yet. And so I think it's more a matter of, with young people, of just supporting young folks to actually be rebellious, but to be strategic about it, right? Because too often we grow up just rebelling, 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 and not thinking about anything that we're rebelling against. So rebelling against, like, treating everybody as our equal enemy doesn't get us anywhere, right? And so it's more about, like, supporting young people to think critically and to make smart risks about what they actually want to rebel against and ask questions about, like, what is this thing that I'm resisting and what is it actually related to and what do I actually want from this resistance? What am I trying to get? And I think teachers can do that. I think social workers can do that. I think nurses can do that. It doesn't just apply to students. It applies to patients, all kinds of people in the realm of, like, working within institutions that supposedly are set up to provide some form of social welfare.
Great. Well, I'm sure that our listeners would love to hear a little bit about sort of ways that folks can get involved and ways that folks can find out more about the work that organizations like the Prison University Project and like Critical Resistance are doing. So maybe if you can just kind of share a little bit about how folks can plug in, at least to start learning, right? Like, learning the history that you were referring to.
Well, some websites that people can check out. CURB, Californians United for a Responsible Budget, is a really big coalition of more than 40 organizations throughout the state of California that is working to transform California's budget priorities away from imprisonment and policing and towards education, healthcare, housing, et cetera, et cetera. We've been doing a lot of work to fight AB 900, which is this huge prison. It's the largest prison expansion bill in the history of the world. It's set up to build 53,000 new prison beds and cost, like, billions and billions of dollars. So we've been working to shut that down, and we've also been working to fight realignment on local levels and prison expansion on local levels. So down in LA, people are mobilizing to fight a new jail that's being built by LA County. And locally, we're trying to fight a jail from being built in San Mateo. So the website to check out is curb, prisonspending.org. Another more local fight here is against gang injunctions in Oakland. The website for that is stoptheinjunction.wordpress.com, and that's an ongoing fight. Stop the Injunctions Coalition is a coalition of a bunch of different organizations, from folks who are from East Oakland to all over kind of the Bay Area, lawyers, organizers, people who are named in injunctions in Oakland, lots of young people. And the city of Oakland was trying to pass more than a dozen gang injunctions at one point, and we actually shut all of those down. So right now there's only two temporary in Oakland. But that's a major way that young people in Oakland and people of color are criminalized, and that gangs or groups, basically groups of working class people who are organized and have some structure to their relationships, are being criminalized. So that's definitely a good website to check out. There's also a really cool resource called Stop Storytelling and Organizing Project. And that's a project that was started by this organization called Creative Interventions. And Creative Interventions would facilitate community interventions into different situations of harm, specifically sexual violence and domestic violence, and different forms of intimate violence amongst a particular community or family. And Creative Interventions has worked to collect stories of different communities around the world, talking about some of the strategies and the interventions that they've actually done to disrupt violence, mostly interpersonal violence, but there's actual stories that you can listen to. And all of these interventions do not involve policing or imprisonment or other forms of traditional social services like child protective services. So it's actually like seeing anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, abolitionist politics in practice in terms of actual responses to violence. And then another website you can check out is prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com, which is the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition's website. So we're going to be putting up some videos of family members talking about how they want to commemorate the first anniversary of the hunger strike, and there'll be updates on that struggle as we keep moving forward with it.
You can also check out prisonuniversityproject.org if you're at all interested in teaching or working with the on-site college program at San Quentin, and also, of course, criticalresistance.org. If you're in the Bay Area and you're wanting to know what abolition is, that is definitely the resource and website and organization to get involved with.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for coming in. I think, again, there's so much to learn from thinking about organizing around the prison system, which is, you know, the most extreme space and site of the violence of capitalism and of the state. So we look forward to continuing this conversation in future shows, and I also want to invite our listeners to check out our archives, because we have had some of these guests in before. So there's, within the archives of Relatos Zapatistas, which is the former name of this show, you can find some earlier interviews. So we're going to go to a musical break real quick, and then we're going to come back and talk about the Davis Dozen situation, the Banker's Dozen as they're referred to, a group of students and faculty and staff that have been pretty outrageously criminalized at UC Davis. So we'll be right back.